Now we're at a very micro level with our data, and we can actually target doctors and patients at a micro individual level.
Welcome to AI for Pharma Growth, the podcast from pioneering pharma artificial intelligence entrepreneur, Dr. Andre Bates. This show aims to demystify AI for all those in biopharma, from startup biotech right through to big pharma. Each episode focuses on all things AI and future tech related to help pharma execs to navigate through the and benefit from the sometimes confusing but magical world of AI-powered tools to grow and get real-world results.
Today's episode is called What is Artificial Intelligence and How Can It Help Pharma Grow? Many of the episodes I do, I'm interviewing a guest, but today I've had so many queries about this where people are not really getting what AI is and how it can help them. I thought I would do an episode that really is devoted to helping you understand what AI actually is, and particularly with relevance to pharma. I have worked in pharma for several decades, and I've worked with all the top 20 companies and others. I've worked on hundreds of AI projects in that time in areas such as clinical trials, market access, medical affairs, market research, and sales and marketing. So I will guide you through some of these different areas. So let's start with what AI actually is. If we think to an example of something you may be familiar with, Airbnb. So Airbnb is a platform that allows people to rent out their room or house or apartment for a particular period of time for a specific price. What's very interesting about Airbnb is that they created a pricing algorithm using machine learning, which is a type of AI. And so what that pricing algorithm does is it searches the internet and finds properties in similar locations to the property that you're planning to rent out. And then it will work out what is the optimal price for you to put that property in their platform for. And what it's looking at is all the other properties that are vacant at the same time, what their prices are, and what price will get you maximum occupancy and maximum profit. So you could ignore what they suggest, and you could price it higher, which would give you more profit per person, but a lot less occupancy. Or you could price it lower, and you would have a lot more occupancy and a lot less profit per person. But the price they recommend, based on the algorithm, is done in such a way that you will have maximum profit and including occupancy. So the bottom overall line is the money that you get in the bank will be most at that point, and the money they get in the bank will be most at that point. So that's an example of a machine learning algorithm. If we think about something else, another example, Amy. So Amy is my personal digital assistant, and I just interact with her as I would with any other assistant. But she only has one task. What she's very good at is scheduling meetings. So if I have a meeting that has to be scheduled, I will CC her in the email to the person I'm scheduling with or people I'm scheduling with and say at the end of the email, Amy, could you please schedule this? Then she will go out and send emails to the relevant people, check my calendar, talk to them about their calendar, and set up everything. And she does it so well that so often I get people emailing me afterwards and saying, could you thank Amy for me? So that's another example. And then if we think about Amelia, who is a digital human, Amelia can do pretty much anything a human can do. So apart from anything physical. So you could train her to be a doctor, you could train her to be a lawyer. What she's most normally trained for use in companies is customer support, tech engineer, help desk engineer, and so on. So that's yet again another example. And she can communicate in text, in voice, etc. But what do all these different examples have in common? Well, they're all using a form of artificial intelligence. Now, there's actually, if you think broadly, there's three types of artificial intelligence. You will have heard of narrow artificial intelligence, which is pretty much most of where artificial intelligence is right now. Then there's general artificial intelligence, and this is where AI is really functioning pretty much completely like a human being. So they have the same sort of perception and so on. And then there is artificial superintelligence, which is where artificial intelligence is functioning far, far superior to what any human could ever dream of. But those are the three broad categories. What does that mean? So we actually have lots of subtypes of artificial intelligence. But before we get into that, let me just briefly explain where the term artificial intelligence comes from. It comes from the concept of the fact that these algorithms, so essentially, firstly, artificial intelligence is the intersection between maths and computing. So if you think about mathematics, you can write algorithms on a page. You can't do that with AI because everything is coded. So it is really that intersection. And so why it's called artificial intelligence is it's a little bit like how the human brain processes. So in the human brain, if we are learning a new skill, for example, say we're learning to play tennis or learn piano or learn a new language, whatever it is, the more we practice that skill, the better we become at it because the more dendritic pathways form and make it easier and easier to do that skill. So artificial intelligence is a little bit like that. So instead of practicing a skill, it's data. So the more data that the system can use, the more accurate the system becomes. And so we have so many different types. We've got pattern recognition, fuzzy logic, natural language processing, intelligent agents, evolutionary computing, machine learning. And then under each of these, you've got lots of different subtypes. So an intelligent agent is something like Amy. But under intelligent agents, there's more than one type. So she's a utility-based agent, which means that she can only do one particular thing. But you can also have agents with goals, reflex agents with memory, simple reflex agents, and so on. And then under machine learning, we've got lots of different types as well. So we've got decision trees, artificial neural networks, support vector machines, and so on. And then under those, we've got different types like random forest under decision trees, deep learning under artificial neural networks, and so on. So each of these are very good for different types of data and different problems to solve. So if you're solving one of the challenges you have, the data is language data, then you're certainly going to need natural language processing. Maybe not only natural language processing, you may be mixing it with some kind of machine learning, but it will certainly be a base. If you are doing something with image processing, it's highly likely the type of artificial intelligence you would be using would be machine learning and the subtype artificial neural networks and the subtype deep learning. Deep learning is very, very good for image recognition and image analysis. But all of these different ones have their pros and cons. And so that decision of which one to use is going to be up to your data scientist once they know what they are trying to achieve. The key thing with all types of artificial intelligence is data. You must have heard that AI is very symbiotic with data, and especially big data, because the more data, the more accurate. So if you think about some examples where things have gone wrong because of data, I can think of quite a few. One was kind of an interesting one from the British Army about 30 years ago, and they were using artificial neural networks to detect if there's an enemy tank in the woods. So the data in this case was image data. So they were basically taking photos of tanks in the woods and no tanks in the woods, just the woods, and camouflage tanks in the woods. And then they put it into the algorithms to see what it could predict about when there would be a tank in the woods. And it came out saying, you will only ever get a tank in the woods on a sunny day. Now, maybe the reason that it came up with that answer was because of the data. They only ever took pictures on sunny days. I mean, who wants to go out and take pictures in the rain? But these are the kind of things that you need to be very, very careful of with any AI project, that the data sample you're using is fair and balanced and not biased. And in that case, clearly, it was biased. It may have been not biased on something they had thought of, but you have to be very, very careful with data. Another example was quite a few years ago with Amazon, where they put a machine learning algorithm together to recruit staff. So they put a load of resumes into the algorithm to train it, and then they set it off on people applying for jobs at Amazon. Went quite well. They got great people. But after a while, they realized that there were no people that were female. So it was all male people being employed. So they went back to the algorithm and had a look, and they realized that in the data that they had trained the algorithm on, it was only male resumes that they had included. So they took off that field about the gender, and they found that they still weren't getting women. And they realized that the language that women use and the language that men use in resumes is very different. So they basically had to redo the algorithm. So both of those are good examples of where the data used is not good. I have one more example, which is Tay, which was Microsoft's robot, but a little online robot. So she was designed as a 15-year-old girl, and she was let loose on Twitter. Unfortunately, she started quite well, like a teenage girl. Within 24 hours, she had gone to a Nazi-sympathizing, anti-female, racist, misogynist. I mean, it was completely horrific how quickly she went down. I was so shocked that it happened within 24 hours. And the reason it happened within 24 hours is, if you imagine a child with millions of really bad parents, so she was interacting with absolutely everything on Twitter, which does make me a bit despair for humanity when that's the kind of thing that she was interacting with. But again, it was the data that sent her down that path, and she had to be pulled within 24 hours. So I just want to really illustrate that data is the really, really critical component when you're doing these kind of projects. So how are companies using it in general? Well, one example, interestingly, is McDonald's. They are using it for, I think they spent something like $600 million. I could be wrong with the numbers, but many hundreds of millions on AI in 2019. They realized that the weather, the traffic, a whole heap of different factors change what people buy in their drive-through menu. So now they optimize their drive-through menu in each location based on what is happening at that point in time. And it has helped them increase their revenue quite dramatically. They're now also using it for their supply chain and a load of other areas. Another example is Bank of America. A few years ago, they replaced 50% of their customer service staff with a digital human. I know the digital human well, and she's done incredibly well, so that their actual customer satisfaction has gone up from when they were using just humans. And the reason for that is she remembers every conversation. A human will take notes and put it against the person's file, whereas the digital human will remember the last conversation she had, and she'll remember if they were going to pick up their children or if someone had a cold in their family or whatever they talked about, on top of obviously the banking issues. She remembers and adds that human touch that the humans don't remember and don't add that touch into their notes. So that's another really interesting example where they've not only been able to save a huge amount of cost, but they've also increased their customer satisfaction. Another example is Target, where they were using AI for marketing. And there's this very famous story, it's quite old now, but famous story where a man came very irately and angry into Target and told them that they were inappropriately targeting his 16-year-old daughter with pregnancy and childcare ads. And they apologized and he stormed off. And then a few days later, he came back and he apologized to the manager and he said, "My daughter is pregnant. I didn't know." And so it's very interesting. What Target have done is they decided they still can tell, you know, all sorts of things about people, but they decided to try and make it less obvious. So if they are targeting someone for pregnancy, they'll throw in some lawnmowers and a few other things to make it look like it was just coincidental, which is the best way to do things. And Let's now move to how this applies to pharma. So if we think about it, there's a real shift in the market. You know, in the old days, we used to have data that was very macro level. You might say, you know, 50% of doctors say X. Now we're at a very micro level with our data, and we can actually target doctors and patients at a micro individual level. Segmentation used to be quite fragmented. You probably remember it used to be tended to be on how much someone prescribed or their personality profile. But now segmentation is a 360-degree view of each person. So you can segment down to a segment of one and have fully customized detail aids, marketing communications, etc., for that person based on what they're doing right now. The analysis used to be linear, you know, using statistics, whereas now we can use AI, which is nonlinear, and can really root out these complex relationships between different channels, different messages, different sequencing, different timing. And the drug and the treatments used to be very product-driven, but now they're much more focused on outcome and value. In addition, the ecosystems used to be very static and siloed, whereas now the ecosystems are much more dynamic and engagement-led. So let me give you some real-life examples of how we use it in pharma. We use it actually throughout the entire value chain. So from drug discovery, discovering new molecules, drug design, to R&D, you know, drug repurposing as well, drug screening, manufacturing, quality control, improving production, predictive maintenance, clinical trials, clinical trial design, recruitment, automating CSR writing, etc., market access, value pricing, faster time to reimbursement, answering questions for the market access analytics immediately. Supply chain, we can use it to detect counterfeits, warehouse automation, supply chain mapping. Regulatory, you know, collating daily guidance and regulations. Medical, we can do intelligent literature monitoring, IVDR, MDR compliance, medical insights, medical guideline management, medical information and education. In sales, we can do so much, you know, precision doctor targeting, switch prediction, suggestion engines for sales calls, whispering agents, and marketing, you know, key opinion leader identification, HCP targeting and segmentation, patient targeting and segmentation, finding rare disease patients, automating personalized omnichannel marketing, predicting who will not adhere to a drug and what you need to do to change that, and so much more. So let me delve into a few. I mean, value pricing, you know, this is a really powerful area for AI because pricing, and I think I might actually do a whole podcast on this topic, but pricing and market access and reimbursement are actually becoming more and more complex. In fact, they are probably the most complex part of the value chain these days because there's so much data and so much change. So we're using AI, specifically machine learning types of algorithms, but also natural language processing because of the different data sources, to really do value pricing, weirdly, a little bit like Airbnb do it. So it's really identifying what is the right price that is going to get us maximum reimbursement and maximum uptake for this drug. So you could price it higher and you'll still get sales, but it may not get the same results in terms of you won't have as many patients on it and as much reimbursement approved. Or you could price it lower, you get a lot more, but this middle price, this sweet spot where you're going to get maximum profit. So it can be very useful for that, but also faster time to reimbursement. You know, we've done that in Europe and America, and it's really, and again, that one does use natural language processing and machine learning as well, because what we're doing with this one is really analyzing the different formularies if we're in America, or the different country bodies if you're in Europe, and looking at outside of price, and price is certainly a big factor of it, but outside of price, what do these different bodies need? You know, some of them may need a certain level of clinical data. Some may use a particular type of language that sways them. Some may, there's a whole heap of different factors. And if you have actually access, which sometimes we do from the sales reps, the account managers, who is on the pricing committee, on the reimbursement committee, you can actually, you know, understand that those committee members a lot more and get even more accurate with doing this. And typically you can save, you know, minimum 6 weeks to several months in getting your drug to market much sooner using this. Another example would be identifying key opinion leaders or thought leaders or influencers in a therapy area with artificial intelligence. So we've done this quite a few times where clients want to map a particular therapy area with big data, because in the past what they used a lot was either how often this person was published or talked in conferences. But what is interesting is that doesn't necessarily mean they're influential. Just may mean that they publish a lot or like to talk a lot. So when you do it with artificial intelligence, you're actually mapping every person in that space. And so you may end up in a specific disease area with 35,000 people. And then you map them in terms of how much of an influencer they are, their connectivity, and the impact factor. You know, you don't get that from conventional things. What is the impact of this person in changing how others prescribe or think? And so then we typically, after we get mapped the whole space, bring it down to the, say, the top 200, and then really assess each impact factor in much more detail for each of those and rank them with, in terms of order of influence and their profiles. So the kinds of things you can do with that is validating your strategic brand plan, pressure testing how you think about who you thought were the top influencers, and what's interesting is many times it's not what you thought. Identifying blind spots in the MSL engagement strategy, looking at rising star and fresh faces that you can identify to recruit, to work with, better publication planning, and better congress interaction and communication planning. Another area which is big and great for AI is identifying patients in rare disease. So I've got two examples of these where we've done it in two very different ways. One was a third line cancer product. And in this case, many patients died at second line. So finding the third line patients was both rare and difficult to do. So to address this challenge for our client, we used patient record data, electronic medical health records, and identified all patients who had ever been diagnosed to third line as a third line patient, even if they were dead right now. And then we backtracked and compared what is the difference between these patients and the patients that died at second line. And the wonderful thing about AI in these kind of projects is it analyzes trillions of data points, you know, in seconds. Whereas as a human, you're probably looking at the obvious data fields. You don't actually have to, you don't necessarily include every single data field in a medical record, but the AI does. And so that way we can start to predict with the highest degree of probability which currently alive second line patients are likely to progress and stay alive at third line. And then from that, now we don't have their personal information because it's all anonymized. But what we do have is who their doctor is. So we can then send a sales rep to the doctor and give them an idea of what they need to be looking out for in the second line patients, that's going to mark them as someone who's likely to go to third line. And of course, let them know that this third line treatment option is now available. So we have done that with one pharma client recently. And what was great was they actually had predicted that their peak sales were going to be at $3 billion for this product. And it turned out that within 2 years, they were already close to approaching $3 billion, and the peak sales are going to be much, much higher. Another example was one that we did many years ago for rare disease. And this was one where it was a genetic condition, children were born with it. Unfortunately, if they were not treated, they would die by the age of 10. So we were actually brought in to do forecasting for this drug. But what we realized was a more important challenge for the client was that they were spending huge amounts of money educating any pediatric physician that may come into contact with one of these children. Now, this was actually an ultra rare condition. So you had maybe around 100 patients worldwide. So spending a lot of money getting any pediatrician in the world to know about it was going to be not a good return on your investment, let's say, because 99.999% of these doctors would never, ever see a real patient in their entire working life. What was interesting about these children is if you looked at the photos of them, they had similar facial features. So what we were able to do was write a face recognition program to essentially basically identify the points on the face that would predict that this was a baby that had this condition or a toddler. And so we set it up loose online, and it then started looking at any photo ever uploaded online. And then it started identifying babies before the parents even had any idea that something was wrong. Now, that's really critical, because the sooner you get treatment with this condition, the better. Because the other challenge with this condition was that after 18 months of age, you start to lose IQ points. So your IQ actually regresses. So the sooner they get treatment, the better. And once they get treatment, they can actually live a normal kind of slightly shortened, but well into their 60s. So it was really important to just get them treated very quickly. So once we did that, the algorithm had identified, basically dropped a cookie. We wouldn't do it with cookies these days. This was a very long time ago. But dropped a cookie, like a retargeting cookie, for the people that had uploaded a photo of a child with this condition. However, you've got to be very careful that you don't make someone feel invaded. And that's particularly sensitive in this kind of space. So it's critical to save the lives of these children, but you have to do it very carefully. So the next thing we did with these retargeting cookies is did Google ad buys, so that the only people that would see the ad would be parents of these children, and the ads would be relevant to what they were searching for. So one of the other things we found, because there was a Facebook group for diagnosed parents of these children, was that the parents didn't realize that anything was wrong with the child until they started trying to potty train them. And it wasn't, we had all the clinical data, that was not mentioned in any clinical data, but that was the big thing that doctors didn't even consider. But that's what parents noticed. When they couldn't potty train after a while, they would bring them in to try and figure out why they couldn't potty train. And so the thing they first searched for was potty training. So we basically would do ads for anything that was relevant to what they were searching for around the child. If they were searching for something like, you know, cars or something completely unrelated, they would not get the ad. But if they were a parent of one of these children and they were searching on something to do with the child, like runny nose, potty training, etc., they would get an ad with a picture that was age appropriate to the picture they had put up online and was leading them to a disease awareness website. And literally within a month or two, we had 13 new patients that were identified because the parent had gone to that website and then brought that information into their doctor and got genetic testing. So it just makes me so happy, because that was 13 lives that were saved, which out of 100 and something globally was pretty impressive pretty quickly. And on top of that, for the pharma company concerned, they could stop wasting a huge amount of money trying to educate doctors and actually precisely target the parents of these patients. So that's another example, and that's one we've done many times, not with the face recognition, but rare disease. Other things you can do is physician segmentation. We had an oncology brand that required maintenance therapy after induction. There was a significant number of physicians that were not using maintenance treatment and were preferring to treat at progression. So the client had identified three segments. So those that were always using maintenance, those that were selectively using it, and ones that were not using it at all. So they really wanted to understand which physicians fell into which segments, what were the influences that would lead individual physicians to make the maintenance choices that they do, understand the dynamics between the segments, in particular, you know, the healthcare providers that were always using, selectively using, or never using, and what was the dynamics between those, and what were the appropriate interventions, sales and marketing interventions, that could be utilized to assist the physicians in fully supporting the use of maintenance treatment where it was indicated for the patients. And then in that project, we also mapped the key opinion leaders who believed in maintenance, and we were able to utilize those to speak with their networks and influence the non-believers. I mean, the guidelines actually stated that there would be a better patient outcome if you used maintenance treatments. So it was interesting that there were actually some that weren't. But the outcome of this one was we actually had, within 6 months, 37% of physicians increasing in using maintenance treatment. So again, very, very powerful use. And then there's lots of typical uses that we've done for many years. So for example, precision doctor targeting. You know, we did many projects like this where targeting was based on historical data, and not all these physicians were providing the return hoped for. So there were numerous drugs in the portfolio. They needed to ensure that the reps were seeing the highest value physician. And the solution was really combining all the data into a uniform format and adding temporal sequencing. Then using AI techniques to see which physician had the most potential to write a script, which physician should be a priority based on the most recent dynamic data, identify the maximum share possible for that physician based on the patient population. And in this one, the outcome was that we actually had a huge increase, 31%, in sales after the system was implemented, because they were going to the right doctors and not wasting time on doctors that would never change their prescribing or that were already tapped out and actually maximally prescribing. Another very common use case. Also with sales reps, another one is personalized selling. This was actually one of the earliest ones we did, very long time ago. And this was for a large brand that was in decline, and there were a lot of new brands coming in and generic competition. And so the sales reps felt they couldn't compete anymore. So the solution was actually combining all the data. And what was great about this project, it was actually in Japan, and we had a provider of a doctor's network who could provide us with all the doctors' digital footprints, not just on their network, but throughout the internet. And so we were actually able to get amazing rich data for this project at the time. So we were able to then look at what are the behaviors of doctors before they switch brands. When, you know, so often you would see a doctor after they'd been to a medical education event from a pharma company start to go into journals and search for the competitor brand and look at clinical studies. And so there were lots of things that we started to see that would be a big warning sign to the incumbent that they were mainly prescribing, that they were actually thinking of switching. Then the reps could go into those doctors and the AI would identify what is the right combination of sales messages that you should be giving this doctor at this point in time. And also it was able to pull up the right sales pages, because there was over 1,000 sales pages for this product, because it was so old. It could pull up the right messages for this doctor in the right combination. And this one was very powerful, because this was in the days when no one was doing this kind of thing. And for this one, we actually, once they rolled it out, we did a pilot first with a group of sales reps, and then we rolled it out to all of the different brands. And we got 43% increase in sales overall for that company. So very, very powerful way to go. Once we did that, we realized that we could actually use the same kind of techniques for patients. So we had a client that had an injectable product, and that product was actually done for the first 6 months. There was a nurse that would come to the patient's house and help them with the injection. They also had a call center for those patients, and they had a brand ambassador that would basically speak to the patients. So the drug was actually delivered directly to the patient's house in this case. And we actually had all of that data. We had the nurse note data. We had the call center data with that patient, et cetera, all anonymized, of course. But we had IDs, even though we didn't know who the patient was. So we were then able to identify what are the kinds of language and behaviors that these patients are doing when they start to stop adhering to the drug. You know, they start cancelling the nurse visits, they start saying particular things. So we were able to uncover that. And then before they stopped and reduced their adherence to the drug, we were able to flag which of them are highly likely to be doing that based on their language and behaviours, and what the nurse needed to discuss with the patients, because there was over 250 different reasons that patients stopped adhering. And so it was identifying what are the key beliefs or the reasons that this particular patient appears to be using to stop. That's why they're going to stop taking the drug, stop adhering to the drug. And so the nurses and the brand ambassadors got very personalized, patient by patient, specific actions and messages to really assist the patient understand and adhere to the drug. And so the brand team would get activity reports and brand performance and summaries, but they didn't get that personalized information because that was just for the nurses and the brand center. But we did get quite an impressive uplift in adherence. And then another common thing that a lot of people are doing these days, but we did this a very long time ago first, was really looking at modeling context marketing. So we had a client that had 10 platforms of data on multiple brands in multiple key priority countries, and they wanted to improve the customer engagement and the customer journey. So we really did what we called next best action marketing, which it is, but not rules-based. There's a lot you've got to be very careful in this next best action, because there's a lot of companies that call something next best action and it's purely human rules-based. You really want a next best action which is artificially intelligence powered. So it's learning from the individual journeys, and it's not based on a marketing manager saying, well, if they do this, then we send this. What this kind of system does is backtracks each person, and that can be thousands to tens of thousands of people, their digital journey. And so it's identifying what they've engaged with. And so then when new people come into the system and what they haven't engaged with, and so when new doctors or patients, depending on what you're doing, come into the system, it can identify what is the right content that this person should receive, what is the right channels this person should receive, and what is the right sequence of content and channels that will lead to greater engagement, faster adoption, and of course, growth. So we've had great success with this. I have never done a rules-based version of this. It's always been an AI learning version of this. But when you do an AI learning version of this, which is basically next best action omni-channel marketing with AI, not with rules, you are going to get, depending on how many brands and how many markets you do, you are going to get in the many hundreds of millions, 2 billion of uplift in your brands. So it's a very powerful thing to do, and I recommend it strongly to everyone. So just as a quick recap, what can AI do and what can't it do? Pretty much it can do any neural processing task that a human can do, but it can handle a lot more volume and do it much faster. What it cannot do is choose the data that it needs to do. I was going to say label the data, but actually with generative adversarial networks and reinforcement learning, we're getting more and more self-labeling. But it can't figure out what you need to figure out, which is identify your business challenge and the solution to solve. It can't actually write the software in the first place. It can't generalize the learning to other use cases yet. It can't exercise free will, and it can't think out of the box. So what are the best practices? Well, one of them is to understand your business challenge. That's very, very first step. Don't worry about the AI. Worry about what is your problem? What is your objective? That is your first step. Forget AI. AI can pretty much solve any of these if you think it through cleverly. But look at what is going to make the biggest impact to your business if you solve it. Then you have to look at what data from wherever in the company. And data can be anything. It doesn't have to be in a spreadsheet. It can be recordings of your customer service calls. It can be all sorts of things. So look at what data is available for that, and be very wary, as I mentioned in the beginning, of data biases. And really understand the terminology involved, because I see so many companies, firstly, not starting with the business challenge. They leave the project to the data scientist to figure out the business challenge, which isn't really the best way to do it. And they don't lead the data science team. So it ends in a lot of frustration with the business team and the data science team really not speaking the same language. And it's very easy to learn this kind of thing. I've got many free courses on that. Then also think of the user experience. Who is this meant to be helping? Is it meant to be helping doctors, patients, payers? You need to think about that, because once you help them, you will naturally help the company. Think of Amazon. You know, their whole motto is customer first, but they're the biggest company in the world. You know, once you help your customer or your user, or whoever you're targeting, then it's going to have a knock-on effect of helping you. But that's part of the planning. You're looking at how can you do both? How can you help the user, the end user of your system and your company? So you want a win-win for both of you. And you're also going to have to think carefully about your transparency, your clarity, and your disclosure for regulatory compliance. You know, we've got GDPR, we've got CCPA, and so many others. So you really need to be very careful about your legal and regulatory environment. You need to set expectations because it gets better with the more data, and plan your initial use case and how you're going to measure the return. Plan it as a pilot and test before you go live, and make sure that your cybersecurity is very strong. Have a disaster recovery plan in place, implement your pilot, get your results, and then scale. Challenge is 7 out of 10 companies who are using AI have failed. And here's how to avoid their mistakes. It's really what I just said. Start with your business strategy. Balance your tech with your business needs, not the other way around. Don't focus solely on cost reduction, even though it's very good at that. Effective AI is actually twice as likely to focus on revenue growth from AI. And big ambitious projects are fine as long as you plan them properly. And also make sure that if you are doing a small one, really think about your longer big-term transformation so that the smaller projects can get woven together later into the full transformation. And of course, invest in the right talent, people, and processes. Now, there was a survey in 2019 that basically looked at high-growth companies, and 93% of the super high growth companies were using AI as a source of competitive advantage. Soon, it will be baseline amongst every pharma company. And the more companies that adopt it, if you're not using it for most of your activities, you will suffer against the competitors. So staying ahead of the curve will then be the name of the game. But part of the key to staying ahead of the game is tech, but that can be done by anyone. The big part is data. And as you know, Roche have done some interesting things where they bought Flatiron Health in 2019. I think it was for something like $1.5 billion, but that was for their oncology data. Now, everyone can still use Flatiron Health data, but Roche have a 6-month window before anyone else can use it because they bought it. So it's a big source of competitive advantage. So I hope this has given you some kind of overview to get a base understanding of what AI is and how you can use it in the pharmaceutical industry to grow, as well as help your patients and doctors and payers. So if you have any questions about this, just drop me a line. You can find me at Ularis, ularis.com, and drop me an email, abates@ularis.com. Ask any questions. I will be happy to help. Thanks for listening, and I will come back to you with another episode next week. Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AI for Pharma Growth. If you have received huge value from this show, or maybe this episode has highlighted how you can use AI in your company, then we would love for you to support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating. Please make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app now to make sure you never miss an episode.